Hello, and welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge on to you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, professional mountain guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains, and I've had nipple-length hair three times in my life. Once in high school, again in college, and one more time when I was in my most hardcore ski bum phase of life. Now, I don't have any hair at all. Today's episode of the Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Hakuba Valley, Japan. Just under 3 hours from downtown Tokyo, at the base of the northern Japanese Alps, sits Hakuba Valley, Japan's largest snow resort. Expect abundant snowfall averaging 32 feet per season, 131 trails, 96 lifts across the valley's 9 ski resorts. From gentle groomers to extreme mountain terrain, Hakuba Valley has something for everyone. Visit hakubavalley.com to learn more. Today's Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. Nestled in the west central mountains of Idaho, Tamarack boasts 1,100 acres of terrain, 2,800 vertical feet, and an independent spirit and community vibe unmatched in the West. My guest today is Travis Ganong. Travis is a badass World Cup and Olympic skier who just got third place in Super G in Colorado this month. Travis made the U.S. ski team at age 15. He's been ski racing on the World Cup since 2009. He's won 2 World Cup downhill races. Travis was the first American male to ever win Germany's Garmisch downhill. Travis has podiumed 4 times in World Cup downhill. He's had 38 top 10 finishes on the World Cup. He got 5th place in downhill at the 2014 Sochi Russia Olympics. Travis was 9th overall in World Cup downhill in 2014. He has won 2 U.S. championship titles in downhill and 1 U.S. championship title in Super G. And even more impressive to me, Travis is an insanely talented free skier who's already been in Warren Miller and TGR ski movies. I've free skied with Travis, including at Palisade Tahoe's legendary Chimney, and the guy absolutely rips. Legendary free skier Cody Townsend said this about Travis's free skiing. If Travis hung up his downhill boards today, he'd be one of the better big mountain skiers in the world tomorrow. Even though backcountry big mountain skiing takes a high level of experience and mental preparation, Travis's pure physical skills on a pair of skis could put him on any film trip with any film crew. Hello, Travis. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. How are you, man?
Really good. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to starting the season here pretty quick. Just finished training in Colorado, and I'm headed up to Lake Louise tomorrow, actually.
Your last day before you hit on the world tour, man. So thanks for spending your last night with us.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to have one last day at home. And then, yeah, I'm literally, my bags are packed. I'm living out of my bag for the next, well, I guess till after the Olympics, till February. Yeah, so.
Nice, man. Nice, man. Here we go. And when did you ski last?
Yeah, so I skied the day before yesterday in Copper. We had a Super G session, our last training session of the year. And yeah, it was awesome. We have full length downhill and Super G for the last 2.5 weeks out there. So my ski legs are definitely established. And it's really nice to have a couple of days off actually before heading up north to Canada to race. But it was really good training. We trained with pretty much every national team in the world. And we got to kind of compare our times and see how we were doing compared to the other racers. And yeah, it's been good. I think I'm in midwinter form at the moment, even though it's not really winter yet.
No, that's great, man. It sounds like you've gotten over 50 days of skiing already. I love it. Where's your favorite place to ski?
I've traveled all over the world. I'm really lucky to have been on the US ski team for 17 years now. And even before that, when I was a junior racer on the Squaw Valley ski team, I traveled all over. And yeah, I mean, there's so many amazing places to ski and there's so many amazing ski cultures, but back here in Tahoe and in California, there nothing quite compares to the snow we get and the terrain we have and how steep it is and how the snow sticks to the steep stuff. So like my favorite place still to this day is skiing at Palisades Tahoe, formerly Squaw Valley. It's unbelievable.
What scares you the most in the mountains?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of very scary things in the mountains. There's a lot of risk and there's a lot of hazards and you have to manage all those things, kind of comes with the territory. But for me, the scariest thing is the idea that winters might be going away, climate change. It might be kind of shrinking. Our seasons are disappearing. It's snowing less. The weather's shifting. There's droughts, there's fires. And in such a fragile mountain environment that really affects our way of life and what we do. And yeah, I mean, I've witnessed it firsthand traveling all over the world, going to places where we used to have amazing training and amazing conditions. And now it's just barren dirt and we haven't been there in years. And it's kind of sad. It's really scary.
Climate change is just ferocious right now, especially with the extremes. And so I think that is something to be scared about. What's the scariest race course on earth?
Yeah, so the scariest race course on earth, I think most people jump to Kitzbühel just because it's the most famous race there is. And yeah, there's for sure some scary features on that hill. The top 15 seconds are super steep and in your face. But then you're on this road for 20 seconds dead flat, just cruising through the woods. And so it gives you time to break and reflect and get focused for the next section. And it's actually pretty short too. Like physically, it's not that demanding, even though it's most people jump straight to that. But for me, the scariest course would be Bormio in Italy, just because it's so long and it's always in your face, demanding. There's never a moment to take a break. Super high speeds at the top. And the last like six or seven turns on the bottom pitch are just huge, huge turns. Your legs are completely smoked. And yeah, it's kind of survival skiing. And the surface of the snow there too is absolutely horrendous, because the night before the race, when we roll into town, the hill is normally open for the public, and they're skiing down the hill, making little moguls and then they don't groom. They don't groom it. They just put the gates in the ground and we go up and send it. So it's Bormio is very challenging.
And that's where you hurt your knee as well, right? So, oh God.
Yeah, no, that was like one of my only crashes I've had on the World Cup in Bormio, and it ended up in a knee injury, which kind of sucked, but that's kind of one of the rites of passage of every downhiller, more or less.
What's the funniest accident or a funny story that you've had in the mountains?
Yeah, so it's not, I don't know if it's considered funny or not, but it's a good story. We have our last race every year is up in Norway, in Kvitbjell, Norway, and the layout of the ski area, everybody actually lives at mid-mountain in these kind of ski and ski out hotels. And after the race, you kind of take the lift back up to your room and everyone kind of hangs out up on the mountain. It's pretty cool. And so as the American team, as the US team, we actually normally stay at the races after the race. We don't jet off back home because it's so far to travel. So we, over the years, we've gotten to know Lars, who's the owner of the little on mountain bar right next to the hotel. So after the races, we always go there and kind of unwind and hang out. And his bar has some of the most unbelievable skiing memorabilia you'd ever see. There's panels from gates from every Olympics there's ever been. And there's old skis and boots and everything. Anyways, one night after the race, late at night, I convinced him to grab the ladder and he went up onto the wall and he unscrewed some old wooden skis and leather boots. And he fired up the snowmobile. The boots fit, they got in the bindings, and he took me up to the top of the hill on these wooden skis. And I ended up taking a couple laps at like midnight after the race. And it was an amazing experience. And he didn't think he didn't think that they were able to, like anyone would be able to ski on them. But yeah, I mean, skis are skis, right? And I slid down the mountain and it was pretty fun. So he ended up actually giving me the skis and the boots. And they're here in Tahoe in my shed, and I still go out on them once a year and go rip around. It's pretty fun.
I love that, man. Late at night after a couple drinks, ripping around on wooden skis and leather boots. That is hardcore, man. I love it.
Yeah, respect to those guys who invented skiing, because it's not as easy.
Oh man, it's intense. What's your favorite ski movie of all time?
Yeah, my all-time favorite ski movie is Hot Dog the Movie. It's a classic Hollywood kind of ski film. It's not your traditional ski movie, but it's
a soft porn, man.
It's a little bit, yeah. It's probably the first time I ever saw some boobs on when I was a kid. It's cool because it's based here in on the North Shore of Lake Tahoe and at Squaw Valley, and it kind of pits the Europeans against the local hot doggers, the California boys, and it's really similar to what we actually do on the World Cup. We're kind of the underdogs here in the U.S. and we travel over to Europe, and kind of all the funny little subtleties you have from Hot Dog the Movie are pretty accurate when it comes to like the Germans and the Austrians and the Swiss. And yeah, it's a good movie. It's fun to kind of, I've kind of lived that life a little bit, I feel like.
I love it, man. Think of that Euro-American rivalry that exists in the skiing world, especially on the World Cup, because it's almost all based in Europe. So that our listeners can watch Hot Dog, do a little taste of that, taste of what your life has been like. I love that. What's your favorite book or books?
there's a really good book by Dick Dorworth called Night Driving. And it's kind of a story of him driving around the Western US from ski area to ski area at night. And like the things that happen in the desert in the middle of the night and cruising around the Mountain West. It's a really good book. If you're a diehard skier and you love the Western US, it's a must read.
Have you ever been hurt while skiing?
I've had a few injuries over the years, but yeah, one of my first ones, when I was like 14 years old or so, I went to New Zealand with the Squaw Valley ski team for summer training camp. And we were at Mount Hutt, near Methven and training a bunch. And I remember one afternoon after training, I saw there was a half pipe competition going on. So I convinced the coaches and some of the athletes to kind of stick around. And yeah, well, I entered the competition. So I ended up going through the qualifying round and made it into the finals. And I think I was getting ready for like my fourth or fifth run in the pipe that day. And obviously I don't ski that much half pipe, but I was doing all right. And I was starting to like try some new tricks and going a little bigger. And in the final run, I kind of went a little too big, a little too fast and did a big 720.
Whoa.
And a little bit over rotated. And in the compression of the pipe, twisted my knee in the compression and ripped up my meniscus. So that was tough. That was tough. Got like calling the parents back home being like, hey, so like I got hurt. It wasn't ski racing. It was in the half. But yeah, it was good. I mean, I think it was a setback, but it also like was the first step in like learning how to be a professional athlete and like doing the rehab. And I think that in that first injury kind of set the tone of like, oh, like this can go away in a heartbeat, you know, like I'm going to maybe be a little more careful from time to time. And I'm going to like make sure my body's prepared in the right way so I can like hopefully avoid injuries in the future. So
knock on wood. Absolutely. And you blew your ACL just before the Olympics in 2018. Was that just devastating for you?
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely a setback going into my second games. It was 3 weeks before going to South Korea.
Oh.
And the race in Bormio, Italy, I just like hit a hole kind of weird and got high-sided. And normally it would have been not a big deal, but that year they didn't have that much snow. And so they had extra B-net around, going over this side hill. Normally I would have just slid down the side hill and been able to stop. Uh-huh. But they had set up these extra nets. So I went into the nets and got all twisted up and blew out my knee. So yeah, after the initial setback, it actually gave me a moment to kind of reflect on my career up to that point and like get a little perspective about like why I love ski racing and why I was doing this and if I wanted to keep doing this and all these questions. It gives you a moment to reflect. And ultimately it gave me enough time to realize like how much I absolutely love ski racing and how much I wanted to come back and continue to push myself and challenge myself and see what I could do. And so, yeah, without that forced break, I think, I don't know if I would still be ski racing now that I'm 33, but because of that forced break, I think I could keep skiing for many more years, I think.
And I hope you do, man. And I know what you mean. I blew my knee and my ACL, ripped off some cartilage from my femur, just vaporized the meniscus in 2015. And I've never been so hungry to ski. You know, when I was out like that, I realized I had been taking so much for granted and I just pushed me so hard. I wanted to be back, but it took me forever to come back. You know, I didn't ski for 6 months. And then it still took me 18 months to get back to normal. How long did it take you to get back after your ACL tear?
I think I also didn't start skiing for 6+ months. The rehab I was doing in conjunction with my fiance, Marie Michelle, she blew out her knee like 2 weeks before me in Lake Louise. So obviously that was devastating at first. And then I was off racing and then I blew out my knee. So in the end, we ended up like living together and doing rehab together. We were living like monks and spending hours with videos and in the gym and doing exercises for 6-7 hours a day. It was amazing going through that with someone else, you know, like that made it a lot easier to the point where I definitely progressed really fast back from my knee injury and came back maybe stronger than I was before, which was really cool. We also started working with a new trainer down in South Lake Tahoe. His name's Nick Ward. And he was amazing. He kind of like he retaught me how to move and how to fire my muscles and how to move properly, you know? And so working with somebody like that and also having the time to dedicate to rehab, like, allowed me to come back really strong and in a not very long amount of time, which is cool.
All right, Travis, it's only 75 days until the Winter Olympics in Beijing, China. And you've had a badass World Cup and Olympic ski racing career that's still going strong. I'm just going to rattle off some of your stats here. You made the U.S. ski team at age 15. You've been ski racing the World Cup since 2009. You've won 2 World Cup downhill races, which is insane. You were the first American male to win Germany's Garmisch downhill. You've podiumed 4 times on the World Cup. You got 5th place in the downhill at the 2014 Russia Olympics, which is so cool, man. You were 9th overall in the World Cup in 2014. You've won 2 U.S. champion titles in downhill and 1 U.S. champion title in Super G. So again, 75 days to the Olympics. How are you feeling about the Olympic Games, and are you nervous?
I'm really looking forward to the Games this year. I think my first Olympic appearance was an amazing experience. I was a rookie and I had a breakthrough performance that time in my life. And since then I've gone on to obviously, yeah, have some really amazing results and yeah, at world championship events, winning medals. And so, I mean, I think I've been able to accomplish a lot in my career since then, to the point where now I'm like, kind of, I don't have the experience. I have the results to kind of back up my second Games, and missing the last Olympics with a blown out knee also makes these next Olympics super exciting. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to trying again to see if I can better my 5th place. And I think as far as the pressure goes, like, I'm really focused on the World Cup tour at the moment. We're starting next weekend up in Lake Louise. Actually, we have 2 downhills and a Super G there. And then we have 2 Super G's in a downhill the following weekend in Beaver Creek. And then we go to Val Gardena, Italy for a downhill and Super G, and then Bormio for a downhill Super G, and then Bengen for 2 downhills, and then Kitzbühel for 2. So we have big events coming up before the game. So I'm not really thinking about it too much at the moment, but yeah, I'm looking forward to kicking off this World Cup season again and qualifying for the US team, and then hopefully going to Beijing and yeah, enjoying myself.
And you mentioned this a little bit before the show, but you said that maybe, what's the pressure like? Do you feel more pressure at the Olympics or more pressure at the World Cup?
I think a lot of people would probably say Olympics are much more nerve-wracking. But for me, I think the Olympics are always kind of like more of a bonus at the end of a big season. Like the World Cup tour in its own is very demanding and very challenging, and the tracks are often a lot more challenging. The competition is actually more difficult at the World Cup events because 10 athletes per country can compete, versus at the Olympics, there's only 4 guys competing. So getting good results on the World Cup is actually maybe more indicative of who's the best skier at the time. And yeah, I think the pressure at the Olympics is less affected on me than some other people, just because I focus on the World Cup season more.
So what do you know about the coming Olympics in Beijing? Is there anything quirky or unusual about these Olympics? You know, I've heard that it doesn't really snow there. It's mostly artificial snow. And is that good or bad for skiing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very new place in the world for skiing, and especially ski racing. And so there's a lot of big question marks, and nobody's been there yet. It's with COVID-19, all the test events have been canceled. And so, yeah, a lot of big question marks going into the event. And for sure, what I've heard is that there's not really much natural snowfall. It's really, really dry. It's right on the edge of the Gobi Desert. And it's they have to pipe water in from really far away and make snow. But ski racing, we ski on man-made snow anyways every race. It's kind of like how they want the venues prepared anyways. So that's not going to be much different. The crazy thing I've heard from everybody, though, is how cold it is there. It's apparently one of the coldest places on the planet. And it's also super, super windy because it's right on the edge of the Gobi Desert. So it's like between the wind and the temperature, I doubt we'll be able to start from the top of the downhill. And I think we're going to probably be freezing the whole time we're there. So we'll see. I don't know. I always look forward to skiing in a new place of the world. And yeah, it'll be fun.
So Travis, we're so excited about you being in the Olympics this year. So I think a lot of people want to know, what do ski racers do between Olympics?
A lot of people ask me what I do in between the 4 years when I'm not doing the Olympics. They don't realize that there's a whole World Cup season every year. So the world champs are kind of one tier down from the Olympics as far as like overall worldwide recognition. And the qualifying for a world championship team is the same as the Olympics. So the team size is way smaller than at the World Cup. Only four guys get to race in each event. And then the Olympics every 4 years is obviously what everyone thinks about when they think about ski racing.
Thank you for that. Because, yeah, I've been so curious about that. I was reading, like, what is this? What is World Cup versus World Championships? So thank you so much for clearing that up. And for you, what is your favorite ski racing discipline?
I've always raced downhill and Super G on the World Cup. When I was a kid, I raced all the events. I love the speed events just because of the adrenaline and the speed and the jumps and the amount of focus that is needed for it. And the fact that you only have to do one run a day. I think those tech skiers are crazy for having to go back up and do a second run after.
Oh man.
But I love free skiing and I love pushing myself and the adrenaline that you get from that. And downhill ski racing is the closest thing that I've found to like skiing a big line in Alaska or like jumping off a cliff or something, that feeling you get in the finish. Even if you had a bad run, like that feeling is unbelievable. And in the other events in ski racing, you don't really get the same feeling like that as you do in downhill. So yeah, for sure. Downhill is my favorite.
And downhill I think is the funnest, most fun to watch. How fast do you guys go when you're racing downhill?
Yeah. So a couple of years ago in Vengen, Switzerland, the highest speed was recorded at 102 miles an hour.
Holy shit.
Johan Clare, the French guy, it was insane. And I think that day, I think I hit like 99, almost 100 that day. And it was fast. I think the average top speed is like in the 80s, 80, 85, something like that. But it's weird when you're going that fast, like it's kind of hard to feel the speed because there's no other people on the hill. The gates are 50 to 100 yards apart and you're going from the top to the bottom of the mountain. So like there's no sense of relativity. You're just like kind of the tempo between the turns is so long that you don't really realize like you're going that fast until like every once in a while I stand on the side of the hill and I watch a guy ski by and it sounds like a jet engine and it's absolutely terrifying. Like I hate watching from the side. So, cause I'm like, oh, I'm going to go do that next. That's crazy. But yeah, no, when you're actually in the setting doing it, you don't notice the speed, which sounds crazy. Yeah.
Well, that's insane, man. So how dangerous is ski racing?
Yeah, I mean, it's very dangerous. And obviously like slalom and giant slalom are a little less dangerous, but then once the speeds start picking up in Super G and downhill, things get a lot sketchier. And I mean, injury is kind of part of the game. And I mean, you can imagine going from the top to the bottom of a mountain on ice, not really on snow, on injected snow, which is ice.
Yeah. Tell us what injected snow is.
Yeah. So as like an insurance policy, more or less, the organizing committees for all the races, they make all the snow, they groom it, and then they water the hill and let it freeze into like an ice skating rink just in case the weather shifts and it gets warm and it rains before the race or something happens. And it helps them from having to cancel the race when it gets warm. And also it makes the conditions maybe a little more fair for the whole field, because you can imagine with 60, 70 guys running the same downhill track, the course could get pretty chewed up if the snow is soft. So they prepare the hill to the absolute extreme iciness, which is not great. I love skiing in soft snow personally, and I can't wait to finish my ski racing career. My body's going to thank me for skiing past. But it's crazy skiing on that surface.
I bet, man. What kind of injuries do ski racers see?
I mean, knee injuries are the most common for sure. Like, I think the torque you get on the knee from, we're skiing on 223 centimeter downhill skis. So that's a long lever.
Wow.
And a lot of the injuries actually happen from going into the fences on the side of the course, the safety nets, and getting twisted up and that stuff. I mean, the alternative is you go into the woods. So, I mean, we need the fences there. But yeah, that knee injuries are very common, back injuries, broken hands. Every guy in the World Cup has a long list of injuries.
I'm sure going 100 miles an hour would lead to that. How many bad crashes have you had?
I've only had one. I've the one when I blew up my knee in Bormio. My style of skiing is very controlled and very safe, and I'm really balanced on my skis. So even though I'm going really fast and pushing myself, it's hard to see because I'm normally not really putting myself in a sketchy position. And so that's kind of translated in my career to really not having that many crashes. I've literally only crashed once, which is, I think I've raced 130 World Cups or so. So that's a pretty solid record. I'm going to knock on some wood again here. But
that's amazing, man. I'm going to remember that. Yeah. Cause everybody else I talk to is like, oh man, thousands, you know, just ridiculous.
People like call me out on it too. They're like, oh, you're not pushing hard enough or whatever. But I don't know. I just, I like skiing within myself and being balanced, and I don't know.
Sounds a lot easier on the body, man. I like that. And you're obviously doing well, so it's working. And how much fear is there? How scared are you in the start gate before a race?
Yeah, I mean, fear is definitely always there. I think, like I was talking about earlier, it's actually really important to have that fear and have that respect for the hill, because it kind of elevates performance and brings out these amazing performances and hones your focus. And I mean, I've learned to love fear in the sense that I live with it every day when I'm racing and training, and I use it to kind of fuel me and get me in the right mindset. And a lot of people can't handle it. A lot of people never quite get to that relationship with fear. And I think that's maybe also why I haven't crashed that much in my career. I don't know. Yeah, I just had that realization, I guess.
That's great, man. How grueling are these races? When you get to the bottom, are you just feeling like you're just pulsing with lactic acid? Are you just completely thrashed at the bottom of a World Cup run?
Short answer, yes. I mean, it's it's taxing. It's like the most intense anaerobic workout you would ever do. And your legs are just like two tree stumps at the bottom. You can barely walk. It's pretty intense. Like, especially at a place like Bengen, Switzerland, I think it's 2 minutes and 45 seconds of racing. And the last turn into the finish is this huge compression. And it's a lot of people like can't even stand up through the finish and they crash into the finish. It's not for lack of trying. Like these guys, all of us, we train the entire off season in the gym, lifting weights and working out, and everybody's a beast. Everybody's super strong, but we're literally pushing our bodies to the absolute limit. And yeah, it is exhausting. So the race weeks, we have training runs. We have two or three training runs the days leading up to the race. And then normally we race on Saturday and Sunday. So there's 5 days in a row of kind of pushing your body as hard as you can on these 2 to 3 minute race runs. So yeah, that's why we train so hard in the off season. And that's also why, like, after each run, we go back to the hotel and we spend hours doing recovery and flushing the legs and seeing the physical therapists and trying to get ready for the next day. And it's not just the one run you see on TV. There's a lot that goes into that, and making it through an entire World Cup season is very physically demanding, and it's tough. Yeah.
Got to be thrashed at the end of the season, man. How do ski racers make money? Is there a good system in place?
Yeah. I mean, there's a good system to make money through the World Cup races with the prize money. They pay from first place all the way to 30th place in the World Cups. So as long as you're the top 30 at the end of the race, you're making money. And the prize money, the highest paid race is Kitzbühel. They pay 100,000 euros for the winner.
Whoa.
Down to maybe $1,000 for 30th place. So you can imagine a season where there's 10 downhills and 9 super Gs. I think the minimum prize money, I think, for winning a race is 32,000 euros. So everywhere between that is kind of the realm. So if you have 18 races a year, you try to maximize your performances and results that way to make some money. And then you also can double down on that money with contracts from your ski companies and headgear sponsor. I'm sponsored by Cliff Bar. They're my headgear sponsor. So that's kind of we're only allowed to sell one logo on our helmet. The ski team controls all the rest of the logos. And those other sponsors that the ski team gets, they actually fund our season. They pay for the flights and the hotels and the coaching. And,
oh, that's great.
So yeah, I mean, like ski racing, if you do make it all the way to the World Cup level, there is an opportunity to make money, which is really cool. But the difference between first and 30th place is 2 seconds sometimes or less. And so if you're just outside that window, it drops off fast for sure. Like the guys winning are making a ton of money, and the guys getting 20th, 30th are making little money, and the guys 30th to 60th are not making any money. So it's not like similar to like tennis where the top 100 guys in the world are rolling in money. You know, it's still pretty tough to make a living for a lot of people, but at the highest level of the sport, it's pretty good.
I've heard you say that everyone in the World Cup is so good that one of the main things that differentiates who wins is the mental game. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that everybody we've all skied since we were 1.5, 2 years old. Everybody has the best equipment. Everybody is really, really strong and talented on their skis. So at the ski race, what it boils down to, other than like the wax, how the skis are tuned, which skis you choose, the speed suit, the weather, the wind. I mean, there's countless variables, but say everybody has all those other ducks in a row. the mental game is definitely the last 10%. And the ones who can week in and week out perform, it's amazing because every track is different. Every venue has different risks. There's always something else going on in everyone's life anyways. Like how do you get your mind in the place to perform on that given day, on that one run, that 2 minute run? Like that's, there's a lot that goes into like performing in that little tight window, you know? So over the years, I've definitely like learned tricks to put myself in the right mindset and enjoy the process. And I think the one simple thing that I do is 10 seconds before I go, when I'm in the start gate, I always kind of hit the pause button and look out from the start. Cause normally the downhill starts at the top of the mountain, right? So I look out and I'm like checking out this mountain range, wherever I am in the world. And I just give myself a little time to have perspective. I'm like, wow, I'm so lucky. I'm standing on top of this mountain in Italy and I'm super lucky. And this is amazing. And it like, it always makes me smile, which I think also triggers something in my mind. That's like, all right, it's time to enjoy the ride. And then like 5 seconds to go, I kind of like click my poles and like hone back in. And then I just black out. I don't remember anything until I cross the finish line. So those are the runs that are like, that everything comes together and the plan is so dialed that I can just turn my brain off and react, which is when like amazing performances come.
I think that's one of the secrets to life. One of the secrets to being successful in life is being grateful. And your 10 second before the race thing to look around and say, hey, I'm grateful to be here. That's a great mindset to be in. And I got to ask you this. I'm so curious. We had Bodie Miller on the podcast last year, who's the winningest American downhill skier of all time. And you were on the team with him for a while. What was it like skiing and hanging out with Bodie Miller?
That was pretty fun. That was, that was one of my first years on the team. I was a young up and coming skier and he was kind of during the end of his career, he was doing his own thing with Team America for a couple of years. And then he was back with our group for a couple of years. And when I first made the team, he was kind of the only guy performing at that time on the downhill team. A lot of the other guys had previously won races, but then they were kind of like in a lull at the time. And so as a young rookie on the team, I was kind of the other guy who was scoring points from time to time and getting into the top 30. And it was really fun to actually work with him and hang out with him and talk to him. And we had an amazing relationship. I mean, it was really fun traveling and learning from him and also learning what not to do from him. he was a very unique athlete and he was an amazing athlete. And yeah, I definitely learned a lot from him, but also learned a lot what not to do from him too, which is, yeah, you always have to like pick and choose good things and bad things from all your experiences and turn that into something that works for you. So
yeah, Bodie definitely seemed like a rowdy, unique individual.
Definitely. I mean, I definitely learned all about the World Cup very fast hanging out with him, especially after the race was over and going out and having some good times with him for sure.
That's fun, man. I'm jealous of that. Today's episode of the Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Hakuba Valley, Japan. Discover Japan's largest snow resort with the Hakuba Valley Day Pass. Get access to 9 ski resorts and the Valley Shuttle for under $60 a day. Or show your Epic or Epic Australia Pass to claim 5 complimentary and consecutive days to Hakuba Valley with no blackout dates. Explore untracked powder and world-class terrain at Hakuba Valley, Japan. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. You might come to Tamarack for the views that unfold across the valley or the unspoiled terrain and vast open bowls. Maybe you'll come to uncover a place that's a little different, that's down to earth and at home on the path less traveled. But we know you'll come back because there's a community of people at Tamarack who make you feel like you're in the right place at the right time. Let's switch to free skiing really quick. This is something our listeners might not know about you, but I've gotten this free ski with you. I've seen how good you are on the big mountain and in the air. And if you weren't on the World Cup, I'm confident that you'd be in all the free skiing movies. And actually, legendary free skier Cody Townsend even said this about your free skiing. Here's a quote. If Travis hung up his downhill boards today, he'd be one of the better big mountain skiers in the world tomorrow. Even though backcountry big mountain skiing takes a high level of experience and mental preparation, Travis's pure physical skill on a pair of skis could put him on any film trip with any film crew. So I love that quote. How does that quote, how does hearing that quote from Cody make you feel?
Wow. Yeah, no, that's nice. I mean, I grew up free skiing more than racing, more or less. And all of my idols when I was a kid were free skiers, not racers. And I love that world. And I wanted to be in that world. That was like, first and foremost, my goal in skiing was to be a free skier and go film and travel the world and do all those things. And I got to the point where I was like, I would do one or maybe two runs in the course and I would ditch my race skis and go grab my powder skis and just lap KT all day and like push myself. And I loved those years. It was super fun. And I remember one moment, it was a very pivotal moment in my ski career. I think it was, I don't know what time of year, but it was a big storm, one of those classic wet California storms. And it just caked Eagle's Nest with the most beautiful spines I've ever seen. And I think I was 13 years old or something. And I normally like first couple chairs on KT, everybody just does like nose to fingers and gets after it right away. But that day I saw those, the spines up there and I was like, oh, I'm going to literally like click out of my skis and hike up there and go do this. And so by the time I got up there, I think people were on their second lap and Shane McConkey and Scott Gaffney were going up the chair and they saw me hiking up. And so like, I mean, the KT, you get to see everything from the lift. So when somebody starts climbing up something, like everyone starts watching, you know, everyone kind of like posts up and like, what's going on? So those guys were standing there. I got to the top and I did like, I think it's called like X line or something. It's like skiers left, furthest left on Eagle's Nest, like dropped into the spine, did a couple turns and like jumped off the bottom and skied down. And Scott and Shane skied over to me at the bottom, just above the mini fingers or whatever. And they're like, oh my God, that was amazing. Like, who are you? Like, what is like, I remember that. And I was like the coolest thing ever. And so I ended up skiing with those guys the rest of the day.
Whoa!
And showing them like some of my skier spots and they showed me their spots. And after that, I actually ended up skiing with Shane a fair amount. And yeah, it was super fun growing up and being in Tahoe that time. I'm sure you were there that same time period skiing a bunch, but the whole point of that story though, is that fast forward a couple more years when I made the team, I was really torn. I was like, I for sure could have gone off and started filming and doing fun things.
Yeah. How did you make that decision? Ski racing or free skiing?
Yeah. So my dad actually met with Rob and Scott and Shane and they kind of chatted a little bit. And the advice that we got was like, hey, like keep racing as long as you can. Like the doors that open up in the ski racing world were much more established at that point. And the opportunities were endless in that regards. And so that's kind of the conversation I had with my dad. And then fast forward 17 years and I'm still racing. So, I mean, I'm stoked on the decision I made. I think ski racing is the most challenging aspect of skiing there is. And yeah, it's going to be the hardest thing I ever do in my life doing this ski racing thing. And I hope that at the end, I still got it for free skiing. I would love to spend some time chasing that dream a little bit too.
That's what I wanted to ask you next is when you're done ski racing, if you're into it, do you think about maybe pursuing a free skiing career? Cause you know, Darren Rawls basically did that. You know, you're another person on the US ski team.
Yeah. No, yeah. Darren's another huge role model for me. And I mean, part of me says, yeah, like I want to go do that. And the other part of me is like, I've been competing my whole life and like, my whole life. And maybe I would enjoy like going to ski for myself, you know, like I'm going to still go out there and be super rowdy, but do I want to go spend countless hours waiting for film crews to set up and try to get these shots? You know, I've been on a few film trips with Warren Miller and Sweetgrass Productions and it's a lot of work. I mean, it's full on work. It's not all glamour, like what you see in the ski film. It's a lot of downtime and waiting and planning. And I don't know, I've spent so much of my career as a racer waiting for ski races to happen and traveling the world and not skiing as much as I want to ski because I'm trying to rest for the race. I do like two or three runs a day when I'm racing to try to like keep energy for the actual race run. So I'm really looking forward to like finishing ski racing and actually skiing a lot and skiing for myself. But yeah, who knows? We'll see what happens.
Nice. And where did you guys film when you filmed with Warren Miller and Sweetgrass?
Yeah. So Warren Miller was up there at the Alaska segment up at Points North. And I was with Mitch Todler, who's a snowboarder from Austria, legendary big mountain snowboarder.
Nice.
And I was up there with Danny Day and Tom Day. Danny and I grew up together in Tahoe. We're the same age, played T-ball together. And yeah, it was super fun. Like Tom remembers like me growing up with his son. And so, yeah, we were all up there together for 2 weeks in Cordova. It was tough weather. We had a really tough weather year that trip. I think we were there for 2 weeks and we skied one day.
Oh.
And we ended up pushing the trip another 3 or 4 days. And we finally got like 3 or 4 days at the end. And we were able to put together a segment, but it was like just a little taste of what Alaska is because the conditions were not ready for sending, but it was still fun. And yeah, I'd love to do more of that one day. And then with Sweetgrass, it was actually one of their first trips ever filming Nick Wagner. He was down in Las Leñas and I randomly met up with those guys in Mendoza. I was down there with Mike Wilson actually. So before,
oh yeah,
before our ski team, US ski team training camp in Portillo, Mike convinced me to go with him to Las Leñas for 2 weeks. He was down there with the Levitation Project and I was going to hook up with Sweetgrass. And so we flew into Mendoza and there was a monster storm hit Las Leñas. So we were stuck in Mendoza for like 4 days. Like my camera was stolen. Like, I don't know. We ate amazing food and we like drank some wine and it was an amazing trip. And then we got to Las Leñas and Nick and I went out and climbed and skied some amazing lines that whole trip while Mike was building kickers and skiing rails with the Levitation Project guys. And it came out in their hand cut movie, the first Sweetgrass production movie, which was pretty cool.
That's really cool. And for our listeners, Las Leñas is in Argentina. It is one of the best ski resorts in the world. The place is just huge. It's raw. It's again, another place that's been affected by climate change. They haven't got a lot of snow recently in the last 10 years or so, but used to be just the mecca of free skiing in the Southern Hemisphere. So definitely a very special place.
Yeah. And I can't wait to get back there one day because I was pretty young when I was there and all my coaches on the US ski team were pretty bummed that I like was down there doing that. So I was not expending that much energy so I could show up to camp in good form. But yeah, I can't wait to get back down there. I got the, I don't know if you've seen the secret map of all the lines there.
No.
Ooh, yeah. There's,
I'll have to come check that out.
Yeah. I still have it somewhere stashed away. It's similar to like the Squallywood book, but it's one map showing every single line that's ever been done there and all the names. And it's cool.
Whoa. I would love to see that. I'll have to come up with that. And actually on that note, do you have anything in your contract with the US free ski team that you're not supposed to like pro athletes often baseball, you're not allowed to ride motorcycles or anything like that. Is there anything explicit in there? Like, hey, you know, no free skiing or anything like that?
No, there's nothing at all. I mean, I think downhill ski racing is already like at the extreme of what skiing is. And yeah. I mean, I don't know if they encourage or discourage, but we're all skiers to begin with and we love skiing. So I've never heard of anyone ever having something like that. Yeah.
What's your favorite kind of terrain to ski when you're not on the race course?
Really, really, really steep stuff and like intricate terrain. I love getting into some like really intricate, steep stuff. I mean, I think that's the most fun. And that's when like, you have to just react and play with the mountain. And I did a steep clinic, up at Mike Wigley's years ago and
oh wow,
got to teach a lot of the clients went up there to like learn how to ski the steeps. And so Wigley's is known for like super flat, mellow, long powder runs. And so we actually got to ski some steep stuff and like Squaw is littered with really steep, short, but really steep little zones. And I just love kind of like, I've pioneered a few lines that have never been really skied before, just kind of billy goating and getting into some like connecting pad to pad, like on steep stuff. I don't know. Yeah. I love that kind of stuff.
And I love watching you do that kind of stuff, man. So yeah, I'm excited for your post race career. And I heard that when you were a kid on the Squaw Valley ski team, that if it snowed more than 3 inches, you guys wouldn't even set up the race course. You go free skiing. Is that true?
Yeah. I don't know if it was like a 3-inch rule or the 6-inch rule, but I think anytime anything, I would be the first one to ditch my race skis and go ski around. No, it was really fun. Actually, the whole mentality of our team growing up was, why would we sit around and slip and shovel this race course to get some mediocre training in today? Like, let's go lap KT. That's going to be better training anyways, you know? And that mentality is why Palisades Tahoe, formerly Squaw Valley, has produced more world-class athletes and anywhere else I can think of. I mean, it's, that's it.
I love that. Cause that was my next question actually is why does it push out so many World Cup skiers? And I think that's part of it that you guys have that, hey, let's just ski the mountain. Let's do what the mountain is allowing us to do today. And that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of other ski areas don't have that terrain, you know, like having access to that terrain, everything I've skied at Palisades, Tahoe, Squaw Valley, a lot of the stuff is tougher than what I race on the World Cup. And
yeah,
almost every other ski area I can think of I've ever been into has nothing that even comes close to that. So, I mean, the famous saying is that our best coach is KT22 at Squaw.
Oh, I'm going to remember that. That's fantastic. And I said, and do you think, are you still bummed to miss a powder day when you have to race or train or something like that? Or have you gotten past that?
Well, luckily when it's a good powder day, the training and racing is almost impossible. So a lot of the times actually, like, we're at a venue and the whole side of the mountain is closed off for the race. And so the public's not really allowed in that zone. So we actually lap these zones without people. And I've had some really amazing powder days in those situations. Like one example, like my fiance Marie Michelle 2 years ago in Sochi, Russia, the women have been back there a few times for World Cups unsuccessfully. Like, it's just been dumping snow every time they go there. And the downhill track cuts the mountain in half. And so the only way to get to the other side is to go through the downhill track, and you have to have a credential. And so she spent 4 or 5 days in Sochi just lapping like waist deep powder every single day, sending me videos and photos. I was stuck over in Europe in the rain or something. And I get super jealous. Or like the invent of web cameras at ski areas, like when it's dumping back home in Tahoe, I'm just glued to that thing, like watching the fingers race at like 6 p.m. at night when I'm like just about to go to dinner in Europe. I'm sitting there watching the fingers race, like, oh my God, I wish I was home doing that. But
I love it, man. I love that you guys get private powder, occasionally at least. That's tough to beat. Not a lot of people get access to that.
Yeah, there's some perks for sure. I mean, the powder days are definitely few and far between compared to what they were when I was growing up, but still get a few in.
And so let's talk really quick about tricks on skis. You mentioned earlier you could do 720s, 540s, and a half pipe. What kind of tricks can you do on skis?
I mean, my tricking days are long gone, I think. when I was a kid, growing up in Alpine Meadows, our backyard was like a perfect little ski hill. And so after training and after school, I would be out there in the dark building jumps. And like I built a big quarter pipe on my parents' chimney and built a big jump off their deck and did all sorts of crazy things. And like, I remember the Nagano Olympics in 98, I guess I was 10 years old when Johnny Mosey did his dinner roll.
Oh yeah.
I remember for the next like week, like going out to the kicker in the backyard and doing dinner rolls. And like, I don't know. I used to be really into all that stuff and like going to the park and yeah. But now yeah, tricks are, I'm done with tricks. I love skiing really steep, like intricate terrain, really good snow, and the occasional cliff if it's a nice landing. But
I love it. Nice, man. Thank you for that. I wanted to touch on really quick on performance enhancing drugs. Do you think performance enhancing drugs are prevalent in ski racing?
I mean, it's so hard to know. I mean, we do get drug tested all the time. Just last week in Copper, the FIS sent the drug testers and we did blood and urine testing, and they got pretty much the whole world who was there. They tested maybe 40 or 50 people, and it's really hard to say. There's been rumors over the years that like back in the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of the Austrians were doing stuff. And I mean, Hermann Meyer has like an asterisk next to his name on his FIS profile. And some people talk about some of that stuff. And Hans Knaus, he kind of took the fall for a lot of those guys back then. But it's all kind of hush hush under the radar. So it's really hard to actually say one way or another if something happened or didn't happen. I mean, for sure, like when it comes to recovery between races and between runs and in the summer when you're training like up on the glaciers, like the ability to recover faster and have more energy that allows you to do more runs, more repetition, you're going to get better. So like that, there is like, that would make a difference, you know, that would make you a better skier if you were taking something to do more runs and be more efficient. But it's really hard to say if anything happens. Yeah. I've never seen anything and I've never really heard anything definitive, but.
Nice. Well, thanks for that. So body and fitness, you're about 33 years old now. How's your body holding up after 20 years of ski racing?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty good actually. I think growing up, ski racing as a kid, I didn't really go to the gym. I didn't spend that much time training in the off season. I just skied a ton, biked a ton, went backpacking and played soccer. And back then, like, I think my body hurt more back then than it does now, because now the whole summer is I'm really I've learned how important it is to like train the right way. Rest is a new thing that's really helped me a lot. I'm really bad at resting, but now I'm realizing how important rest is. I mean, I think now that I have all this experience as a professional athlete, it's allowed me to eat better food and rest and do the right kinds of workouts and stretch and just take care of myself to the point where I'm feeling pretty good. So
Travis, that's all I got for you, man. Do you have anything else you'd like to add here at the end of the show?
No, I mean, that was great. It was nice to catch up and, yeah, looking forward to another awesome season just about to kick off here. So yeah, I mean, I hope you have a good winter as well. And maybe in the spring we can meet up and make some turns.
I'm excited, man. We'll definitely be rooting for you. Travis, it was great talking today. Thank you so much for being here. And yeah, I'm excited to ski with you again soon, man.
Cool. Sounds good. Thanks, Miles.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Snow Brains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snow Brains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snow Brains. Today's episode of the Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Hakuba Valley, Japan. With 9 ski resorts and 131 trails, Hakuba Valley has something for everyone. Discover deep powder, big mountain terrain, and snow activities for the whole family at Japan's largest snow resort. Visit HakubaValley.com to learn more.
Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. For the free spirits that hear the call of the undiscovered and believe the future truly is boundless, Tamarack Resort is the place for you. And we can't wait to welcome you with arms wide open. Find it together at TamarackIdaho.com.
This episode of the Snow Brains podcast was edited by Jared White, music by Chad Crouch, and I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark.